From Iowa to Georgia, Kentucky to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, will the supply chain Grinch steal Christmas? Finding that perfect gift might be harder than usual this year. We'll learn why from Christine McDaniel of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Senate Republicans have given Democrats a blank check to fund the president's Build Back Better agenda, should it pass. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. It has been 88 years since the end of prohibition on alcohol, but states today continue to use prohibitionist policies to gain revenue. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And critical race theory is steeped in Marxism. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Shoppers this holiday season are finding empty shelves and more than the usual number of out-of-stock items when ordering online. Is the supply chain Grinch stealing Christmas? Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She is a former Deputy Assistant U.S. Treasury Secretary and was the senior trade economist for the White House Council of Economic Advisors during the Trump administration. She joins us now to discuss supply chain issues. Christine, welcome to American Radio Journal. Christine, we are now just a couple of weeks, less than a couple of weeks before Christmas, and folks are hopefully in the holiday spirit. They're out trying to buy gifts. With supply chain issues, how much of a problem is that for consumers this holiday season?
Oh, thank you. So nice to be here, Loman. It really depends on what you're looking for. Services, not so much of an issue, but if you're actually looking for something physical, like a consumer good, could run into an issue, particularly on appliances, furniture, things that are fairly larger consumer durable goods.
The country is, of course, still, as is the whole world, trying to recover and get somewhat back to normal here, Christine, in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Looking beyond Christmas and the supply chain issues relative to consumers, what impact are you seeing as an economist on these supply chain issues in terms of our economic recovery?
That is a great question. I wish I had a crystal ball, but it does seem like this is not going to be a short-run phenomenon. We're talking to different manufacturers across the country and then different people in the shipping industry, and they see this going on for months, if not years. Jay Powell, chairman of Federal Reserve, was saying the virus is controlling this economy. You know, whenever there's a new strain coming out, markets get scared, people might be staying home a little bit more. So it's really going to depend on how things go with the pandemic and then people's responses to those developments with the pandemic. When people stay home and or not come into work, or when a country that happens to be in a major supply chain experiences a big breakout and they decide to go into shutdown, that is going to have ripple effects across the supply chain into the global economy. A global supply chain is really only as strong as its weakest link, and we've got a lot of links in there.
We see a lot of pictures in the news, Christine, of cargo ships just sitting off the coast, particularly the West Coast. They're not getting unloaded. And that's contributing, of course, to the supply chain issues. Why are we having this problem even whenever goods do arrive on our shores? Why are we having problems in getting them offloaded and then delivered to their final destination?
The lines are really, really long. And it is so many different things going on, but they've all kind of come together for the perfect storm. You can kind of think of this through a very simple example of the average person. When COVID hit, probably had to stay home. Maybe you lost your job. Maybe you could work from home or you just stayed home. Remember, right before COVID, the economy was running really well. They were running the economy pretty hot. I mean, remember, unemployment rate used to be less than 3%. So demand was going strong, the economy, you know, but supply was keeping up. And then when COVID hit, boom, at first demand fell off a cliff, but then demand picked up again and then even picked up even more. You know, people were at home. They decided they didn't need the gym membership, but instead they were going to buy new running shoes or they were going to buy a Peloton machine. But the demand for things moved from services to goods. So they started ordering all these things. And then meanwhile, a lot of those container ships that used to be going back and forth between Asian ports and U.S. or U.S. ports and Europe and so on, a lot of those ships had been rerouted for China to get its PPE equipment around the world. And so you saw a real big diversion of ships from China to all corners of the world that they don't have a lot of things to send back. So those shipping containers were either sitting there empty for a while or they were getting sent back to China or wherever empty. That takes time. Meanwhile, the demand for goods is going up and the people who are making them and exporting them don't have the container ships they need. So that's one delay. Then when they do get the container ships, it gets out, but then there's big delays on the ports because the ports are getting overloaded. There's just been this surge in demand. The ports can't keep up. The logistics industry runs really well, performs really well when it's barely in keeping up, right? That's when it's most efficient. But when it gets overloaded and overloaded for a long time, and then when different parts of the supply chain around the world shut down, that's where it really runs into problems. And that's where we are now. And so we see a long buildup of lines at ports because just demand has been so great, but also some different rules and regulations. I mean, there's this act called the Jones Act, which says that only U.S. flagged ships can move from one U.S. port to another U.S. port. So if a big ship is waiting, say, at Long Beach, and there's a port up north that could take them, they cannot do that if it's a foreign ship. So they've got to wait a day, a week, sometimes even more. Sometimes it's weeks for their turn. So there are some of these old rules and regulations that are making things worse.
We have been talking with Christine McDaniel. Christine is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center located at George Mason University. Christine, tell us a little bit about Mercatus. Also, you've written an op-ed on whether or not the supply chain Grinch is going to steal Christmas. Where can folks go to read your writings?
We're the Mercatus Center. Mercatus is actually Latin for market, so it's Mercatus. We are at George Mason University. And basically, we're sort of a research and think tank. We're really more of a bridge between academia and policymakers to basically try to help to inform policy discussions, help inform policymakers so they have all the facts and figures in front of them as they're going in to make their decisions. But yeah, we're at Mercatus.org, and you can find all of our work there.
Christine McDaniel from the Mercatus Center. Christine, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, and we have a lot of fiscal action at the U.S. Capitol this past week, as well as a vote, perhaps a show vote, on the vaccine mandate. We're going to talk about all that. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
As we have mentioned on this show a number of times over the past few weeks, December, a critical month on budget and spending issues, including that ever-present debt limit that nobody ever seems to actually follow at the end of the day. There's been some movement on that this past week. What's the deal?
If you go back to earlier this summer when Mitch McConnell said that the Democrats needed to increase the debt limit on their own, this is an issue that he wanted them to feel responsible for when it comes to financing the Biden agenda through the stimulus plan, through the bipartisan infrastructure plan, through the Build Back Better Act, all these trillions and trillions of dollars that the Biden agenda calls for. Mitch McConnell said, you know what, the Democrats need to do this on their own. And when they came to sort of a standstill in October, ultimately McConnell and about a dozen of his Senate colleagues went ahead and fell on the sword and helped the Democrats do a temporary debt limit, which has taken us to this moment that we're in right now in December. And McConnell has sort of a lot of quotes that he's used throughout the years, especially when it comes to government shutdowns
And one thing that he says is that there's no education in the second kick of a mule. And what that means is, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you know, shame on me. And what's happened in this week is that McConnell has been working on a negotiation with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to basically create a rule in the House of Representatives that would allow for the debt limit to come over to the Senate and set up this unique process where it could be passed out of the Senate with just a simple majority vote. And that would, you know, allow for Republicans to say that they all voted against the debt limit. Well, what happened this week is, to pass that rule through the Senate, you still need cloture. And McConnell and most of his leadership allies went ahead and accommodated the Democrats in that effort. When the rule came over from the House of Representatives, I'm not kidding you, there was actually a blank space in the bill that says that the Democrats can basically have a blank check to finance the Biden agenda, to have a blank check to finance any of the Green New Deal spending priorities that AOC and Nancy Pelosi have been trying to jam through Congress underneath unified government for the Democrats. And so we think it's actually pretty outrageous that Mitch McConnell and his leadership allies in the Senate would effectively hand over a blank check to the House Democrats, to Joe Biden and his administration, and the Senate Democrats that are still continuing to negotiate on that Build Back Better reconciliation plan.
Speaking of Build Back Better, we have talked about it for months now, and the negotiations are ongoing. Senators Manchin and Sinema appear to be the Democrat holdouts. Any movement on that, some behind-the-scenes action this past week?
Yeah, well, if you go back to even the passage of Obamacare back in 2009 and 2010, we always know that the power of one senator to extract concessions on major presidential agenda items is very unique and powerful because of the Senate's ability to block cloture on the filibuster. And what you've got here with this reconciliation bill is a 50-50 Senate. They don't have any ability to lose a Democrat senator because we know that none of the Republicans are going to vote for it. But what you've got here is Joe Biden working with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to try to get to a final agreement by the end of the calendar year, which really means by the end of next week, because we know that Congress doesn't want to be around the week of Christmas or the week between Christmas and New Year's. And so when you look at the specific items that Kyrsten Sinema appears to be negotiating, and to her credit, she's privately been negotiating, which is typically seen in good faith when you're negotiating with the administration. Obviously, we'd like to see some transparency, and we'd like to know exactly what she's asking for so that they can be scrutinized by the American public. But Kyrsten Sinema has said that she's got several priorities. One of them is making sure that there are no rate increases on corporations or individuals. Well, on the other hand, Joe Manchin has said that he wants to increase those tax rates to pay for the whole plan. So it makes you wonder, is Joe Manchin, Senator Manchin, and Senator Kyrsten Sinema, do they have a working agreement that they're never going to get to final passage because the two of them are so far apart on their priorities? Well, that remains to be seen. But there's a bunch of anomalies that I think that they'll try to get accomplished. Kyrsten Sinema has also been talking a lot about sort of a climate change green agenda with tax credits for green efficiency. And think about Joe Manchin. Where does he come from? He comes from a big coal state where a lot of those green energy subsidies aren't going to benefit his constituents. So getting all 50 on the same page and allowing for Kamala Harris to cast that vice presidential, president of the Senate tie-breaking vote is going to be a heck of a challenge as we enter the final weeks of December.
A vote that actually took place this past week, Scott, was a vote on President Biden's vaccine mandate. And Senator Manchin and another senator, Senator John Tester from Montana, voted with Republicans in opposition to the mandate. Is this going to have any real impact?
What this was a Congressional Review Act vote, which is basically Congress's way to provide oversight on executive rulemaking. We know that Biden has issued these unconstitutional mandates, and all four of them are being challenged right now in the courts. But the Congressional Review Act allows you to get a number of signatures on a discharge petition and basically force a vote on the ability for the regulation to go forward. And what we saw in the Senate this week was Manchin and Tester vote with all the Republicans. And what that means is that the House of Representatives will have to take a vote as well. If three Democrats vote with all the Republicans in the House, then the bill would go to Joe Biden, where he would veto it. And so ultimately, you would need a two-third veto override for the regulations to actually be thwarted. That's why I kind of think that this is a show vote. But what it actually points to, in my view, is that there are real political vulnerabilities that senators like Manchin and Tester are beginning to recognize when it comes to these unconstitutional violations on our health freedom. And so it's going to be a real question that I think the courts will also entertain, because obviously the Congress has statutory authority to make law. And if they are speaking in a fashion that they believe that these executive orders, these vaccine mandates are unconstitutional and should be repealed through the Congressional Review Act, then Congress is weighing in on the litigation that's before the courts.
We are talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott is with the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the Club for Growth and your website.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization. If anybody wants to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org. And you can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Prohibition against alcohol was a failure, and many of those same policies are being used by states in an effort to enhance tax revenue. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Steve Greenhut from the R Street Institute.
America's failed experiment with prohibition, that's prohibition with a capital P, ended, the anniversary of its end was this past Sunday. So happy repeal day to you. Pour a glass of your favorite beverage, a tall one, a short one, whatever it may be. But even though prohibition came to an end a long time ago, prohibition with a capital P, we still have a lot of prohibition with a lowercase p, a lot of prohibitionist tendencies still kicking around various governments all over this country. And that's what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Steve Greenhut. He's a columnist whose work runs at Reason.com. You can find him in the Orange County Register as well and all over the place. He's also formerly my boss. So how the tides have turned, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've got a piece up this week at a number of places. It'll be at Reason very shortly, actually. And also, folks can find that at ocregister.com. Politicians are still stuck on prohibition. There's always this tendency in government to say, hey, this thing, whatever it might be, alcohol, drugs, vaping, is bad for you. You can't do that anymore. But it never seems to work, though.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that way. So I started out with the lyrics from the Creedence Clearwater Revival song, Bootleg, about deny them a glass of water and see how good the water tastes. So whatever we ban, people seem to want even more. And oddly enough, many of the states still have really bizarre alcohol rules that are designed to do the same thing. Our home states of Pennsylvania, you know, you still have the state-run liquor stores, and it's incredible how poor the selection and how high the prices are. And many states have different alcohol distribution rules and things that just are designed. They end up being, you know, the Baptists and the bootleggers. The bootleggers, which are the two groups that supported prohibition. Well, now we have other competitors that try to keep these rules in place because it guarantees their market share. And in California, you know, we're going full on prohibition on vaping and flavored tobacco products, which is really crazy because regular cigarettes are still going to be available. And people who smoke or use these nicotine products tend to be addicted to them. So it will force more people back into using the more dangerous products because the less dangerous products are outlawed. So it's just the prohibition idea seems to die hard.
Yeah, the prohibition mindset is always out there. And tell me a little bit more about this new rule in California, because I've read about this, but I haven't covered it extensively. And I don't think many people outside of California are aware of this. But the rule is that effectively it's going to be easier and cheaper to buy traditional cigarettes, the kind that you burn and inhale smoke and tar, than it will be to buy vapes, which, I mean, look, those things are probably not 100% healthy for you, but certainly healthier than the old school cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly. The British Health Agency says they're 95% safer. And of course, it would be ideal if nobody did anything that was unhealthy, but, you know, we're dealing with the real world. Yeah, so the ban, the state passed and the legislature passed and the governor signed SB 793, which bans the sale of flavored tobacco, and flavored tobacco that includes vapes, which almost entirely are flavored, and also Swedish snus and some of the smokeless tobacco products that are much safer also. So people will not be able, you'll go to a grocery store or you go to a convenience store and you won't be able to buy vapes, you won't be able to buy snus, but you will be able to buy some cigarettes that are really deadly.
You just nailed it right there with what you said about it'd be really nice if people didn't do anything that was harmful to themselves. And it seems like governments always seem to think, you know, well, if we just pull the right levers or pass the right laws, we can do that. But unfortunately, human nature is we like smoking. We like drinking. Sometimes human beings just like to engage in what are sometimes dangerous activities. We're talking with Steve Greenhut. He is the Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute. He's based in California, and he's a columnist as well for Reason and a bunch of other publications. And Steve, just about a minute or so left here, but I want to touch on something else since you're out there in California. That's a state that kind of led the way on ending the latest big national prohibition, which is not the illegalness of marijuana, but the fact that the taxes in California on legal weed is so high. That's sort of maintained a weird kind of black market there, similar in some ways to what you had before or to what existed during alcohol prohibition.
Oh, exactly. We've had kind of de facto legalization or decriminalization since, was it 95 or 96 when voters passed medical marijuana, but there was always an easy workaround. You would just get a medical slip saying that you have stress or something. Now we've totally legalized it, but the state's so greedy and the rules are so heavy-handed and the tax is so high that the black market continues. So that's kind of like the mobster getting so greedy that his protection payments get so high that he puts the business out. It doesn't make any sense, but this is California. What do you mean?
Yeah, and it seems like the lesson from that is that ending prohibition is good. Making things that people want to consume legal is good. But if you know, you got to do it in the right way also, like the nuts and bolts of policy matter. And if you need to know more about the nuts and bolts and policy, Steve's colleagues at the R Street Institute got you covered. That is Steve Greenhut. He is a Western Regional Director at the R Street Institute. You can find his work at rstreet.org and plenty of other places on the internet as well. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And again, that is Steve Greenhut, Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute. Check out his latest piece. It's up at Reason.com. Politicians are still stuck on prohibitionist policies, and we're trying to get them unstuck. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of everything going on in Washington and around the country at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Critical race theory is a page straight out of the Marxist playbook. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The reaction by many leftists to the grassroots revolt against critical race theory, especially at school boards, has been very revealing. Their assessment of CRT in schools usually goes something like this. No way, critical race theory isn't being taught in public schools. Republicans are liars. Once it's shown that CRT is being taught, they retreat to step two. Okay, CRT is being taught, but that isn't a bad thing, and Republicans are racist. When those objections fail, creative leftists retreat to the level of MSNBC's Nicole Wallace, arguing that CRT isn't real, that this whole thing is a politically manufactured myth. And that's an amusing position to retreat to. After all, if CRT isn't being taught, then where's the harm in banning it? If it's a myth, what's the harm in banning something that doesn't exist? This would be a little different than, say, agreeing to a ban on unicorns. This whole sloppy mess of illogic sometimes sends leftists dashing to a third step, That is, well, CRT, critical race theory, has nothing to do with Marxism. Well, here, ladies and gentlemen, I step forward to offer my humble services as somebody who unfortunately studies the rot of Marxism for a living. And I can tell you, CRT most definitely has much to do with Marxism. As even the Wikipedia entry notes, critical race theory is, quote-unquote, grounded in critical theory, in the thinking of men like pioneering Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, and its origins are the Frankfurt School and its infamous ludicrous Freudian Marxism. The Marxist basis of critical race theory is extremely important to understand because of how dehumanizing and destructive it is, particularly to children. Karl Marx framed people not as individuals made in the so-called imago Dei, that is, the Judeo-Christian conception of human beings made in the image of God, but as groups to be shoved into opposing categories, pitted against one another. Marx did this according to class and economics, i.e. the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie, whereas Marxist critical race theorists do this according to race, i.e. white versus black or some other ethnic-based construct. One group is the oppressor and the other the oppressed. Your category defines you. Rather than aspiring to the colorblind world that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. envisioned, where individuals are judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin, people instead are foremost viewed and judged by the color of their skin. It's a terribly dehumanizing way to view people. It literally divides people. Consider the assessment of Dr. Wyatt T. Walker, who was close to the Reverend King. Said Wyatt, quote, "Today, too many remedies such as critical race theory, the increasingly fashionable post-Marxist, postmodernist approach that analyzes society as institutional group power structures rather than on spiritual or a one-to-one human level, are taking us in the wrong direction." Says Dr. Walker, "They separate even school children into explicit racial groups, emphasizing differences instead of similarities. The roots of CRT are planted entirely different intellectual soil. It begins with blocks, with each person assigned to an identity or economic block, as in Marxism," unquote. Doctors Walker and King were pastors. They were deeply troubled by a racial theory with Marxist roots, that is, rooted in a thoroughly atheistic political philosophy that was militantly anti-God. Said the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., quote, "Communism, avowedly secularistic and materialistic, has no place for God. I strongly disagreed with communism's ethical relativism, since for the communists there is no divine government, no absolute moral order. There are no fixed, immutable principles. Consequently," said Dr. King, "almost anything, force, violence, murder, lying, is a justifiable means," unquote. Precisely. Such is the profoundly fatal flaw of critical race theory. Look, we all agree that schools should teach the history of civil rights and America's tragic past of slavery and racial discrimination, as well as underscoring the great strides in America to abolish and reverse those evils. Having MLK Day as an annual holiday has afforded precisely that opportunity, as has Black History Month. This can continue to be done without resorting to divisive and destructive Marxist-based critical race theory, which is bad news. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHAI-FM in Greenfield, Massachusetts, WZFC-AM in Winchester, Virginia, along with WEEM-FM in Pendleton, Indiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.